Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It is the second part of our World Cup previews, where today we're going through groups D, E, and F. And I often start by saying this is your favourite intercontinental football podcast. And I'm delighted to say that I can say that again today, because I am joined by the one, the only, the wonderful Mr. Austin Miller of the World Cup After Dark podcast, which means this is still transatlantic, Austin, because you're in Buenos Aires.
It's fantastic, Jack. I'm so thankful to you for having me. You've returned the favor on our show a couple of times, so I'm happy to pick up the tab the other way and be here today.
No, it's a delight to have you. And we'll talk a little bit about World Cup After Dark at the end. We're doing these in groups of three. If you're looking for a place that does your group previews bit by bit, group by group, hour by hour, there is one place to get them, and that's World Cup After Dark. Austin and Amit have been doing such a brilliant job all the way through qualification. One of my favorite podcasts, one of my must not miss podcasts. I absolutely love what the boys do over there. So it's a delight, Austin, to have you on this show, but we've got a lot to get through. So we're going to go straight into it, starting Group D here in part one. And we are going to start with the hosts, the US men's national team, or one of the three hosts, we should say, but I've covered the other two already in Groups A to C. And what I find really interesting about this US team, Austin, is that the expectations versus the reality feels like such a big deal. With this team, you're looking at them and thinking, okay, like, I think this is a very decent US unit. I was very impressed with some of the forward play going forward against Senegal. Still a couple of questions about the goalkeeping and the centre backs, fine. But equally, I don't think this is a team that's reaching a semi-final. But a quarterfinal, I think, would be an incredible achievement for this group of players and would do a world of good for the world of soccer, in which, you know, we both inhabit to a degree within the US. And that also kind of feels, when you say that to some people, that that would be an underachievement. I don't think so. I think this is a good side, not a great side. And we're coming into this tournament, I think, with kind of expectations a little bit all over the place, depending on who you ask within the US.
Yeah, there's this push and pull, I think, with the U.S. And you hit it exactly where I think there's one quarter of the entire kind of U.S. soccer discourse that is, it's a home World Cup. The expectations are sky high. Why can't we make the semifinal? And then there's another quarter of the U.S. soccer discourse that is, but the group, did you see the group? We might go out in the group stage. That's a possibility here too. And I think all of that is kind of fair. And the way that I like to think of the U.S. and expectations is the bell curve, right? And that is how I've come to think about the U.S. And so often at the major tournament, the U.S. hits right in the middle in the bell curve, which is a decent group stage result, a knockout round game against a team that is more talented than them, where they play well but need a couple of breaks, don't get the breaks, and they're out. And so in that, if we take that and we apply it to this U.S. team, you're probably looking at the round of 16 again, right? This is a winnable group, I think, for the U.S. That round of 16 matchup could very likely be against Belgium, who is a U.S. ghost from World Cups past. It's a team they played in a friendly in March, and is a team that, on the right day, is probably beatable. So the opportunity is there. This tournament has obviously been the North Star of United States soccer for 8 years. It's been a long, windy, up-and-down road. That road, we don't have to go through everything that happened in those 8 years, but like, there were some dark moments there for the U.S. They got knocked out of the group stage of a Copa America. That was kind of their last big moment before this World Cup. And so all of that is kind of going into this big pot where it's going to come down to small sample size soccer, which is what a World Cup is. And there's three group stage matches, and there's probably a knockout round game. At some point, they'll run up against a team that's better than them, and they'll put their cards on the table for 90 minutes, and we'll see what happens. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it very much is. I mean, I suppose the question I would ask is this formation now pretty set, do you think? And if it is, and we're going to go with this sort of three at the back that morphs a little bit because, you know, whether it's Alex Freeman or someone else playing on the right-hand side, they sort of become the right back and Serginho Dest sort of becomes an auxiliary attacker. We know that Anthony Robinson on the other side can get up and down. But if there is going to be this kind of double pivot in midfield that's kind of anchoring the front three or whatever that looks like, has Pochettino left himself enough midfielders? Because the Tanner Tessman omission to me still feels like one of the wildest calls that's been made when regards to this roster.
It is. It absolutely is, because this US team needs depth at those positions, and it kind of feels like they might not have depth at those positions. And look, this has the potential to be a very long World Cup, and that means that things can happen, right? Injuries always on the cards. That's something you don't want to happen and is maybe less likely, but yellow card suspensions are going to play a role here. Asking guys to go 90 minutes in increasingly difficult conditions, weather-wise, heat-wise, turf-wise, right? All of that comes down to the more bodies you have at the positions of need, the more useful you can be. And so not having an extra midfield body feels curious. I think, right, the formation feels settled. I think they have to play that formation because of where this team's weaknesses are, which there's kind of two ways to approach having less than stellar defenders, right? You can either try to cover them in the midfield and go back the other way, or you can play as many of them as possible and hope that collectively they'll come together and cobble something together. Feels like the latter approach here for the U.S. Having a question mark in goal is a very new question for the U.S., right? For so long, that was a high spot for this team. I think that's a potential weakness here, and I'm curious to see how that plays out. But as you move progressively up the pitch, I think things get more and more promising. And that's where this team is going to look to make a difference in this tournament. And that's where I think they can be most dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I think that, you know, that win over Senegal gave Pochettino a couple of really nice headaches to have. And we talk about managerial decisions and all of those elements. But in the number nine spot now, he has Flo Balogun, who is a kind of dead-eye sharpshooter in many ways and put in a very good second half performance. But he also has Ricardo Pepi, who facilitated so beautifully in that first half. And the runners off him, we saw obviously Christian Pulisic back on the score sheet, back in the assist column as well. It feels like they're two different ways of approaching a problem, if we'll call it that. And that's, you know, something that hasn't necessarily been a kind of strong point for the US, right? Like, who's going to put the ball in the back of the net has been a question mark for this team for the last, you know, 8 years, I suppose, of this cycle. And it felt like Balogun had it nailed down at one point. And look, we can go all the way back to Jesus Ferreira and Josh Sargent and all of these different names that have been thrown about. Having two serious options in that area with a load of very talented attacking midfielders behind them feels like the kind of right element. If this is going to be a World Cup that brings people in, that, you know, we're getting the neutral to be grabbed by it and be like, wow, I want to see more of this kind of thing. Attacking football is kind of the way forward in that regard.
It absolutely is. And look, I think pre-World Cup friendlies, you can get all over the spectrum with it, right? I think there are things that are worth taking away from them. There are things that are not worth taking away from them. For the U.S., right, one of their biggest questions coming into this World Cup was, all right, where's Christian Pulisic? And there's this whole goal drought. He wasn't playing well for the club. For him to answer those questions in the first 25 minutes of the friendly with two goal contributions and assist and a goal, that's a big, big positive sign, because all those questions are now out the window. They don't have to deal with that anymore. They can focus on playing ball. And yeah, look, Flo Balogun is a high-level finisher for this team. And to get something out of Ricardo Pepi also feels like a big moment. And there are players here, and there are players that have shown, right? They played a friendly against Belgium and the final result wasn't great, but there were moments in that game where they were able to go toe-to-toe with a team like Belgium. And that's what this World Cup is going to come down to for the U.S. is when they play a team that is better than them, how will they approach it and how will they handle it, right? That is the goal for this team. There are scenarios in which they don't get to that, right? This group is full of landmines because there isn't a free 3 points sitting somewhere in this group, as we'll, I'm sure, get to here in a second. But this U.S. team has the expectation of, we're going to make the round of 16. More likely than not, we're going to play a team that is of the second or first tier of world football. And we're going to take our chance and we'll see what happens when they get there. But I think this team can be equipped to deal with that and has the possibility to answer those questions maybe better than U.S. teams in past World Cups.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've spoken so much about the US on radio, on here as well. Feels like we could do a full hour just on the US, but we're not going to. This is the previews. We're going through these groups. So let's talk about some of those landmines. And let's start with the US's first opponents in Paraguay. And this is a team that are going to do exactly what we expect them to do under Gustavo Alfaro. Defensively minded, good at set pieces, hard to beat on any given day. I do think it's interesting that nobody picked up more points in CONMEBOL qualifying after he took over. That singular loss to Brazil, the only kind of red mark on this score sheet. This is a team who have found a DNA again, and I think are reveling in the fact that they have managed to work out exactly what makes them good again.
It's the perfect mix, right? Gustavo Alfaro was the perfect manager for the moment that Paraguay needed. He came in, instilled defensive solidity. And look, I can't describe what Gustavo Alfaro does. I don't know how he does it. The best term that I can use is dark arts and dark magic. He finds goals where goals just should not be found, right? Antonio Sanabria had a long scoring drought for Paraguay. He's had a long scoring drought for his club. Alfaro comes in and he's just bagging in goals left and right for Paraguay. It doesn't matter. They are uniquely dangerous on set pieces at a World Cup where I think set pieces are going to be more important than ever. This is a team absolutely to watch out from that perspective. And look, if ever there was a team to spoil a spectacle, it's this Paraguay team, right? They're going to look up at the big lights of SoFi Stadium. They're going to see all the acts. Gianni Infantino is going to be grinning on the sideline. There's going to be this whole big expectation, and Paraguay are not going to care about it at all. They're going to step out on the field, and they are going to probably try to play as little football as possible, right? They're going to mix up the game. They're going to break it up. They're defensively solid enough to do that. Their best defender is probably also their best attacking player in Gustavo Gomez, right? Like, he's a massive set piece threat. And then Gustavo Alfaro is just going to have his big grin on the sideline, and somewhere deep in his pocket, there's probably a lucky rabbit's foot. He's going to rub it twice, and whatever number nine comes out of that is probably going to be a threat. Sanabria, like I said, he's been terrible for his club, but Gustavo Alfaro has options of players who have been good for their clubs. And look, it's Alexander Arce, Independiente Rivadavia in Argentina. It should strike fear in the hearts and minds of nobody. But it's a Gustavo Alfaro Paraguay side, so it should strike fear into the hearts and minds of everybody. That's the approach for Paraguay. I think this group sets up well for them. I think their ability to grind out points in situations to win low event, low scoring 1-0 games is beneficial to them. And look, that's what they're going to be looking to do here. And I think this is a World Cup where that type of an approach can have success.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, there's a couple of players to keep an eye on. Obviously, a lot of the Premier League watchers who have maybe now translated across the Liga will know Julio Enciso. Yeah. He has that old Dybala nickname of La Joya, and he has really shone in this team. He's been given the opportunity to be like, okay, go and make something fun happen. But I think for me, Andre Cubas in the middle, the Caps midfielder, he's tiny, he is an absolute dynamo, he eats up ground for fun, and he smashes into people, he wins the ball, he puts out fires, like a little Paraguayan N'Golo Kante in so many different ways. I love how he gets about the pitch, and I also love his story. Obviously, born in Argentina, promised his mother that he would play for Paraguay when he grew up, and has become a real heartbeat of this team, I think.
He has. And the midfield, I think, is huge here, right? Right. Diego Gomez is another player that I really like. And they're just going to swarm and take away possession. And there's not a challenge that Paraguay could dive into that they're not going to dive into, right? And they're going to rack up fouls. They're going to rack up yellow cards. And they're going to ask an official, hey, are you willing to call 40 fouls? And again, because if you're not, we're going to commit 40 fouls. They're going to have to pick and choose. That's the approach here. It's not going to be pretty. But this is a team that knows what they're doing. They have stepped up in every big moment under Alfaro. You mentioned the qualifying record was insane. They went from, I don't know if Paraguay are going to make the World Cup, to, wow, they made the World Cup easily by the end of qualification in a pretty short sample. So they're a fun side here. I think their approach to this World Cup is very clear. How far it gets them, I think, is a massive question mark. But look, I've learned to never doubt Gustavo Alfaro, so I'm not going to start now.
Yeah, all right. We're going to go front foot, back foot here. So let's come on to Turquia.
Yeah.
Two of the qualifiers to get here, but might well be favourites to win the group, which is a bit of a strange one to kind of come into, having gone through the long haul and the long way to get there. 24 years away from the World Cup, which seems far too long for a team who made the semi-finals the last time that they turned up in 2002. Heaps of fun, potential to fly under Montella, no pun intended, on L'Aeroplanino. But when you kind of look at this, Yıldız and Güler, twin creative engines who I think work together much better than you might expect. I know there was something similar, and we'll talk about Germany later, but people were like, can you get Wirtz and Musiala into the same team? I think there were similar questions about Yıldız and Güler, but actually it feels to me that they have actually meshed really nicely and their skill sets work well together. Çalhanoğlu oozes class from that deep position, and Orkan Kökçü has been reborn at Beşiktaş. There is a question mark about who plays in the number nine. Is it Can Azun, who's had a great season? Is it Deniz Gül, who I love watching at Porto and has really kind of come into his own within this team? Or is it Barisalpa Yilmaz and that fluid front three that we saw at the last Euros, which again was heaps of fun? I'm just really excited to see this team play.
They're going to be such a fun team to watch play the ball because they're, like you said, they're the exact contrast of what Paraguay will bring. They're looking to play. They're looking to be fluid. That said, I was really impressed by what I saw from Turkey in March, where they had a couple of potentially tricky World Cup qualifying one-off matches, right? The semifinal against Romania, a one-off match against Kosovo, and they handled it pretty businesslike. They won both of those games 1-0. They weren't overly impressive, but it felt like they understood the assignment of being a little bit more defensive, not getting so open, but they have that button if they need it. And I think they can play an open game. Their weakness is at the back, right? They're not going to be able to just shut teams down, but I was impressed by what I saw in March. And yeah, look, those attacking players are going to be so much fun, and they're going to consistently ask questions from every back line and every midfield that they come across in this group and further on. I think they should probably be the favorites in this group. I understand that the U.S. might be the favorite as the nominal pot one team as host here. I think Turkey are really, really good. And I think that match on the third match day could be what decides who ends up winning this group. And I think that kind of match can really favor Turkey. And that should be an up and down, back and forth type game that should be really exciting for a neutral.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's a strange one because you're looking at it and thinking, well, that centre-back partnership doesn't fill me with loads of confidence. And both of these fullbacks in Kadioglu, who scored the goal in the Romania game, I think, and then Zeki Celik on the other side, both of those players are going to want to get forward and make things happen. And I do think that in a tournament where a lot of teams are going to come in and be like, right, we're going to shut up shop, we're going to close things down, Turkey might be a bit of a breath of fresh air for certain neutrals, I think, who are watching them, maybe not for the first time, but the first time in a while, or haven't kind of paid too much attention to that qualification process. You'll remember earlier on in the qualification process, they shipped six to Spain and then they batted six past Bulgaria in the next round to be like, okay, let's just resort out that goal difference. We can't be mucking around with these kind of things. And I do enjoy the fact that when they've kind of got to these moments, they've tended to step on the accelerator rather than the decelerator. And I expect them to come out all guns blazing when it comes to the World Cup.
Yeah, look, the initial Turkey game here in Argentina is a 1 a.m. kickoff against Australia late night. Yeah, that all gas, no break is just going to hit really well at that point in time. And yeah, they're a breath of fresh air approach here. And you said it. They're not, like, pressing the brake isn't what's going to find them success at this tournament. And that should be fun.
Well, they're going to be all gas, no breaks. I feel like it's going to be the exact opposite for Australia. So let's get stuck into them. Tony Popovich's side are very defensive. And one of the little kind of, look, if you're a gambling person, take this. If you're not, don't. But I think a 0-0 against Paraguay might be the nicest bet in the group stages. Just stick that one on 0-0 or under 1.5 goals in that game between Australia and Paraguay. Feels like a very, very good bet at this point. I mean, look, they've kind of eschewed the previous fun and games that we saw at a couple of World Cups before this for some serious, serious discipline. This is a side that knows exactly what it's going to do.
Yeah, and look, Popovic came into this team as the replacement for Graham Arnold when Graham Arnold struggled at the start of the third round of Asian qualifiers, right? There's a couple of negative results. They got beat at home by Bahrain kind of against the run of play. They went to Indonesia and drew. And I think Football Australia kind of said, all right, we got to kind of just bring this in, shut this down, make sure we get to the World Cup. That's where Popovic got the call. They're not going to impress you with how they play. They're kind of a fish out of water in Asia because this is a very kind of English-oriented team that is then chucked into these very weird cultural situations where they're playing Southeast Asia teams or Far East teams or teams from the Middle East. But they are capable defensively, right? I think Matthew Ryan in goal is one of their big players here. He's going to be called on a lot. Their big question mark is, all right, when they're forced to go forward, what does that look like? So Denny Yurick started both of those friendlies in March. He's kind of come into this project. Is he a big target nine that can get it done at this level? A guy that I really like here, I'm worried we might not see him a lot, Jack, is Nestor Iracondunda. He's 20 at Watford. There's a lot of buzz around him. I'm worried that this stage might be just a bit too big to play a fun card like that. But if Australia find themselves chasing a goal, I think that's one guy to look for. Everything else from the midfield and the defense feels very solid. They are going to look to be dangerous on set pieces, right? If you've seen one of these kind of bunker and set piece teams, you've seen all of them, and Australia are right in that category.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a couple of fun players. Motore had a really good end to the season at Norwich. I wonder if he kind of leads the line here and is the person that they look to, considering he's kind of the man in form. But I think a big switch to them was Christian Volpato, who's come back from Sassuolo. He was born in Australia, switched to play for the Italy under levels, and has basically declared allegiance just before the World Cup. I have a funny bit about some of these. I'm like, what do the rest of the team think about this? But given maybe a slight lack of attacking depth, I think he'll be a welcome addition to this side if they need to make something happen in the late stages.
Yeah, and Harry Suter is a great story here as well, right? Been away from football for so long, coming back into it, and he is another one of those big, bulky center back molds that can be dangerous at both ends, right? Tried defending him in the last 5 minutes of a game when he's chucked up there as an extra nine. Look, you could maybe take a pass on first half of Australia games and wait and hope that somebody gets a goal past them and kind of forces them out to play. But look, they're a difficult team in this group. And what makes this group so interesting, as I kind of alluded to earlier, is there's not a team among these four that you are just banking to be 3 points for any of these teams. This group could go a lot of different ways. And finishing first and second in this group will obviously mean big differences. I think that first, you know, finishing first, there's big incentive for these teams to do that. You don't know what finishing third will bring you, whether you're going through or not, what that matchup actually looks like. And so this group, I think, is one of the hardest to predict because it doesn't feel super stratified. It doesn't feel 9-6-3-0 or, you know, 7-7-4-1, something like that. That's not what we're going to get from this group. And so I think that should be really, really interesting. And all of these games, they're not toss-ups necessarily, but you wouldn't be stunned to see any of these four teams come up with any kind of four set of results. And that should make this group interesting throughout the entirety of the group stage.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one where we're going to be looking at both games on the final day and thinking they both well might mean something in terms of qualification.
And it's interesting too, quickly, Jack, that this group is early in the alphabet, right? Oh, wow. Obvious D comes before a lot before K and L, but that means that these teams won't know what that third place table is looking like. Like, they can project what that third place table is looking like. So that last match day is very interesting because depending on where the goal differential is at for the third place team, there may be incentive to go and score, but you don't know how many. It could get tricky.
Yeah, it very much could. And it's not something I thought about, but it's a very, very, very good point.
We're big on guys. At the World Cup After Dark, everybody's got to have a guy on the bench, and your guy needs to know what you need at every spot. You can't be in a situation where you don't know what you need.
Yeah, we're not having any Benfica at the end of that Real Madrid game where they didn't know they had to score this one. Right, we'll put a pin in Group D there. When we come back, we're going to look at Group B, Germany, Ecuador, Cote d'Ivoire and Curaçao. Lots of stories, lots of fun. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's Jack Collins and Austin Miller alongside you, previewing Groups D through to F. And we're going to get into Group E now. Germany, Ecuador, Cote d'Ivoire and Curaçao. And let's start with the Germans, Austin. I'm going to leave that Curaçao story right to the end so you can dig into it in its entirety and in full depth. But Germany come into this tournament in a very odd place, I think, in that they kind of overperformed compared to where they'd been at the last World Cup at the Euros. People got very excited about them. And then we saw a load of really odd results. And now people are talking about them as dark horses. And then other people are saying they can't be dark horses. They're Germany. They're a tournament team. They turn up for these things. But I feel like we risk dropping into cliches a lot when we talk about international teams. And part of me is like, are they dark horses or are they actually just kind of below the level that I expect them to be at considering the caliber of player in here?
It's been a long time since we've seen Germany succeed at the World Cup, right? Two straight World Cups where they fell far below the level that you would expect. I think they're kind of caught in the middle of everything here. Are they transitioning to be a younger, fresher team, right? You've got a new, younger manager in Julian Nagelsmann. Are they trying to repeat the glory of Germany's past? Are they maybe looking to turn the page? They're kind of caught in between all of that. And I think the best example of that is the case of Manuel Neuer, right? Who was very clear, like, all right, I'm done with Germany. I'm not going to be the German goalkeeper anymore. And then he gets to, you know, 6 weeks for the World Cup. And he's like, I'm still playing pretty well. Hey, maybe I'll be the Germany goalkeeper again. And they're just kind of like, all right, we don't really have a better option than that. And I think that's really a good illustration of kind of where Germany are at coming into this World Cup. This group, I think, will challenge them. I think they are pretty clearly not in the top tier of contenders for this World Cup, but they're also right in that second tier. And we'll see how far that can get them here.
I think what's really interesting is you're kind of like looking at them and thinking, okay, you're one warm-up game you've come into and you've won 4-0, but I'm still a bit confused as to what that's actually shown me. And we're now coming in to, you know, the Germany-USA game at the weekend and thinking, I'm still pretty unsure as to what Germany are going to look like, not just in that game, but then also in that first game that they have at the World Cup. And you're like, is this going to be this Lennart Kohl, Jamal Musiala, Florian Wirtz front three, which has the potential to be the most fun front three at this tournament if those three get going and they click? But also, is he going to revert to type? And there was a lot of questions asked about bringing Leroy Sané. He obviously came off the bench here. Saïd Elmaleh was knocking on the door and people wanted to see the young, fresh face. They've gone for a little bit of experience in that regard. But I think that, as you say, the goalkeeping question sums up all of it. You know, is Oliver Baumann going to be the goalkeeper? He started that game against Finland. Or is Manuel Neuer going to start? You can't imagine Manuel Neuer has come out of international retirement to ride the bench. But equally, is Nagelsmann strong enough to be like, no, this is my guy. I've told him he's the guy. You're going to have to win that shirt if you're going to do it. It's just so many questions. And whether he relies on this Bayern core or not, I suppose it is one of them. You know, Pavlovic is in there. Kimmich is in there, but playing it right back rather than in centre midfield, where he's played all season. Jonathan Tah's in there. Nathaniel Brown, who's now signed for Bayern ahead of the World Cup. And he's like, okay, I'm going to give a good account of myself here and off we will go. And is it sort of like we use the Bayern model and we try and absolutely hammer teams and use the little sprinkles of stardust, your Florian Wirtz's, et cetera, to kind of make sure that that sticks? Or is this a completely different game model? In which case, why are you not playing Kimmich in the middle? Like, it feels so weird to try and predict.
And Nagelsmann is a manager who is famous for the kind of sweating out those little decisions and making those little adjustments and tinkering with everything. And he's got a lot to tinker with here. And there's a lot of different options. And I'll add another question based on that friendly that we saw from Germany against Finland. Like, is there a 9 case to be made for Dennis Undav? Is he healthy? But he looked good against Finland. And so, like, all right, are we throwing a more traditional 9 into the picture here?
I mean, this is it. Right now, if you're going to play a 9, he feels like the 9 to play. And, you know, Voltimata is a very specific, unique, unicorn footballer, but I don't think he's a number 9. And then you're kind of looking at it and being like, well, you're not going to go with Füllkrug, surely, at this point. If you are going to go with that 9, it feels like he really is Nagelsmann's only option, but he probably didn't have to be if they thought about this properly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned the Bayern model, right? What have Bayern become famous for? Well, they have a lot of 4 and 9s who come in and score a lot of goals for them, right? A long tradition of those. They haven't really produced a good German 9. I think we're kind of seeing that out at the national team level here.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Well, let's come on to Ecuador. And I know they're one of your favorite teams to talk about. I mean, I suppose what I've written down on the notes here is just go and try and break them down. Ridiculously strong at the back. Finished second in CONMEBOL qualification behind Argentina. And Bekicheche's defensive unit is the envy of a lot of more favored nations at this World Cup. William Pacho, Joel Ordóñez, Incapié, Estupiñán, Caicedo. Best of luck, I suppose, is probably what you would say about it.
Yeah, you want numbers, Jack? I brought you numbers. 18 South American qualification matches for Ecuador, 5 goals conceded. That is an absolutely ridiculous run against talented teams in difficult environments. You bring that defense to the World Cup, you're going to have success. And I think, look, it really speaks to where talent production in Ecuador is at this point. The types of players that we're talking about, right? They had 2 players coming into this squad late because they were playing in the Champions League final for PSG and Arsenal. And that is such credit to Ecuador and such credit to the development process that they've gone through. It speaks to a club like Independiente del Valle, who are producing players left and right that are moving on from that club to bigger and better things. So much of this team has their roots there. I love this Ecuador side. I think they're going to be able to bring that defense to the World Cup. Ecuador, Cote d'Ivoire on the first match day here in this group might be the most physical game at the World Cup. Just 2 teams that are absolutely massive in the midfield. The big question mark here is, all right, where are the goals coming from? Because, all right, they conceded 5 times in CONMEBOL qualifying. They only scored 14, right? So this is a team that is playing low-scoring games. Ener Valencia is still a big hope here. I think he's like on his last legs, but can do it. This is a team, look, if I've said it once, I've said it twice, they're going to defend and set pieces, right? They're looking to be dangerous on set pieces. They're looking to get that set piece delivery that they're looking for. There's some pacey wing options that are like vaguely intriguing. John Yeboah looked good against Saudi Arabia the other night. Gonzalo Plata is a guy who's really found his footing, I think, at Flamengo in Brazil. Kevin Rodriguez, remember, he came out of absolutely nowhere to make the squad 4 years ago. He's developed into a good attacking player. But can this team find the goals that they need in the moments that they need them? Or are they going to be relying on like penalty shootout magic? Because that's what this could look like. That could be the difference between this team making kind of a surprising quarterfinal, semifinal run, or having an early knockout round exit if the goals just aren't there.
I suppose then the question kind of becomes, how do they play it? Are they going to just be like, right, we're okay with it being 0-0 until 70 minutes because we fancy ourselves to keep a clean sheet in those last 20 minutes? Or is there going to be a switch of attitude when it comes to those last periods of games because we know how good they are at keeping teams out? If it gets to it and you're like 0-0 in the first game, 0-0 in the second game, and you've got 20 minutes to play in that third, 3 points might not be enough. Is there enough kind of switch of gears, I suppose, is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Sebastián Becasese isn't a defensive manager by trade, right? Like, this isn't what made him famous as a manager. He had some good free-flowing teams at his various stops, right? He had success with Defensa Justicia particularly. He's been through Racing. He's been through, you know, kind of the ringer of that second level of Argentine clubs. But he came into this team and he looked at what the strengths were and he looked at what the previous manager, who Gustavo Alfaro, who we mentioned earlier in the show, who's now at Paraguay, had done. And he said, yeah, we should keep doing that because that's how we can be the most successful. So is there a case to be made that they should maybe open it up a little bit? Yeah, maybe there is. But then you just get into the thick of a World Cup and I think you lean on what you are best at and where your best players are. And that's at the core center of this team. Like, opposing possession is just going to die in that midfield, right? Like, that midfield is so good and those defenders are so good that that's their calling card. I think they need to stick to it. And I think they need to kind of hope that Ener Valencia turns it back a little bit and scores goals like he did at points in CONMEBOL qualifying.
I mean, you can definitely see the kind of influence of both Sampaoli and Bielsa on Bekicheche, because when you're looking at how intense they are, there's such a kind of level of like dynamism about this team. It doesn't necessarily always translate, but we saw what happened with Bielsa's Chile in that World Cup in 2014, where they won a lot of hearts and a lot of minds, and they weren't, you know, they had more attacking options than this team did. Let's be very frank about that. But you can see where that attitude can take you. And I think that that's something they'll probably lean on.
And one final point here that I think is very interesting, right? Ecuador are going to be super well supported at this World Cup. There is a huge Ecuadorian community in the U.S. They haven't had kind of a ton of World Cup runs, so there is a built up kind of hope for this World Cup there. I have a friend who lives in Kansas City who was stunned, like, Ecuador Curacao tickets are how expensive? I was like, yeah, man, that's the Ecuadorians who are buying all those tickets. And one final point here, if they finish second in this group, they'll go to a round of 32 matchup in Mexico City and then a round of 16 matchup that's also in Mexico City. There's some altitude in Mexico City. Ecuador traditionally play their home matches in Quito, which has some altitude. That's something that you could see Ecuador, I think, use to their advantage as this World Cup goes on.
Well, one to keep an eye on indeed. Let's get across to Africa and Cote d'Ivoire. Another team, they can see their goal in CAF qualification. And I feel like with this team, there's a real point to prove here at this World Cup. Back at the tournament for the first time since 2014, which again, for one of the powerhouses of African football, feels like far too long an absence. I really like the way under MSFA that they shapeshift between this four at the back and the three at the back system. They're very solid. They don't concede, as we've seen in qualification, but even still, you know, this is a team that is set up to defend first and think about everything else afterwards. But they do have, in a way that maybe Ecuador don't, the superstars who are able to bring these moments to life in certain ways. I mean, look, Faye's a great story in himself, that 2024 home AFCON where he was the assistant manager who was promoted in the middle of it and Gassé was fired, and then he went and won that tournament. They were slightly disappointing at AFCON this time around. Some good wins since then in friendlies. They're very quick, very fluid front line who can make things happen on a sixpence. They are actually currently playing France, so we don't know what's happened in that game. It was 0-0 the last time I checked. But you know, for the time being, it feels like a team that really does have the bit between its teeth. And I think they're very, very dangerous in this group.
They are, and they have a way that they want to play that they are committed to. And you mentioned the qualifying record for Cote d'Ivoire. There are different types of not conceding goals in African qualifying, right? Like Tunisia have that record as well. They did it against Equatorial Guinea and Namibia, etc. Cote d'Ivoire did this against a Gabon team that I thought were really good, and they had to be as good as they were because Gabon pushed them all the way to the end of AFCON qualifying. Gabon got into the playoff because of how well they played. Cote d'Ivoire in AFCON qualifying against pretty much everybody that wasn't the Seychelles. I guess the Seychelles, they went and scored as many goals as they wanted to. They got on the pitch, they scored a goal in the first 15 minutes, and they said, good luck. And they just shut it down, and nothing got through them. And that, I think, is their ideal style of play. We haven't seen them do a lot beyond that. But as you said, some of the friendly results, really, really impressive. And the attacking players here are so, so exciting. And the young guys where you're asking, okay, is this maybe a World Cup too soon? But Amad Diallo, Yann Diomande, these are guys that like 20 years ago are World Cup breakout guys that you've never heard of that show up at the World Cup and just impress you. That doesn't happen in this day and age, obviously, but they are still guys that I think can have a breakout World Cup. And look, Cote d'Ivoire are going to try to do that. They want to be on the front foot early because playing a goal up is the perfect situation for this team because of their strength and solidity in the midfield and in the back line. And what MSFA has done is super, super impressive. And this, I think, is a really, really great test for them.
Also, I think that one of the things that they have in their arsenal, one, you know, these young players, Christian Now, I think, is a lot of fun in the midfield, gets forward, box to box, explodes out of those midfield areas. Obviously, everyone is talking about Yann Diomande and where he might end up this summer. Nicolas Pepe's had a brilliant season at Villarreal, and this feels like his kind of first and last dance at a World Cup, which is a strange thing to say for someone who's had a very good career with this national team. He did miss AFCON this year, and I thought that they really, really missed him. But you're thinking about the players that they can potentially bring off the bench. And look, Amad Diallo might start, he might not. Evan Gesson might start, he might not. But El Yawahi, who feels like he's someone that has the ability to make things happen. And Joanne Bonny, who's been, I think, pretty good when he's been given the opportunities this season at Inter. Simon Adingra has been reborn at Monaco after that failed spell at Sunderland. There are players here who really can make differences off the bench. And that, for me, gives them an angle that maybe some other sides that we think of as more defensively minded don't quite have to the same extent.
Yeah, Bonny's super interesting, right? A late pickup for this Cote d'Ivoire team coming into the World Cup, having just switched allegiances. And like you said, depth, I think, is going to be such a big thing at this World Cup. It's so unlikely that you're going to be able to play the guys that you want to play for 90 minutes day in, day out, in the types of conditions we're going to see in the U.S., the types of situations we're going to see. So having a group of, you know, 16, 18, even 20 guys that you can rotate through and play for an hour or half an hour is going to be huge. And I think Cote d'Ivoire are really well positioned to do that. And then, again, you just lean on the defensive solidity that they've shown. That's a good recipe here. And I think a reason why a lot of people should be looking at them as the type of team that can make a dark horsey-like run.
Okay, I'm going to wind you up and let you go on the big one here in Curaçao, who are unquestionably one of the best stories of the World Cup of 2026. They've perhaps stolen a bit of a march via the fact that the CONMEBOL Big Three were missing out, the CONCACAF Big Three, I should say, were missing out in this one. But still, first ever World Cup for the Blue Wave. They got there in some style. They're going to want to play out from the back under returning Dick Advocaat, the little general, as he's known after his mentor, Rinus Michel's the general. But this is an incredibly difficult group to get out of. What does this feel like to you? Is this a free hit? And just talk to us a little bit more about this story.
Yeah, so it's absolutely a free hit to answer that question straight up. The returning Dick Advocaat is fascinating because, look, there are some teams that qualified for the World Cup under one manager and then replaced that manager ahead of the World Cup. And then there's a team that qualified for the World Cup under one manager, replaced that manager, and then brought the first manager back. And that's what Curaçao have done here. Dick Advocaat stepped away for kind of nebulous personal reasons about 6 months ago. Fred Rutten was brought in and had an absolutely terrible March window. Curaçao went across the Pacific Ocean to Australia, and they got run by Australia and China. Look, if there's one thing you've learned from the World Cup After Dark podcast, Jack, you should not get run by China in any international football match. And that's what happened to Curaçao. And the players pretty much said, hey, Dick, we'd love to have you back. We don't really like that Fred Rutten guy. And so Fred Rutten kind of got pushed out, and Dick Advocaat is back. I don't think there's any sort of major changes with that, but it helps the general vibes of this team. They're a great story, right? This is a team that is built from players who have roots in Curaçao. This is a long project that Curaçao have been behind for a long time. This was the goal, right? The goal was to eventually make a World Cup. The World Cup expanding has helped that. But it were good in CONCACAF qualifying. They played good stuff, and they took a Jamaica team that theoretically should have a lot more resources, should have a lot more talent, and should just be a better national team, and they finished ahead of them. And they earned their way to play for a 0-0 draw on the last day of CONCACAF qualifying to make the World Cup. That's exactly what they did. Now that they're here, the challenge is a lot more than Jamaica, right? We're talking about Germany. Curaçao are going to step on a World Cup field for the first time in their history. It is going to be across from Germany. It's a massive, massive ask. And we're also talking about two really good, really physical teams in Ecuador and Cote d'Ivoire. The draw has not been kind here. I think there are groups where you could probably talk yourself into Curaçao doing a bit more. This group might not be one of them. But I will say, I'm not big into pre-World Cup friendly results, and I'm certainly not big into bigging up a team that got beat in the 4-1 game that I'm about to big them up. But Curaçao played 35 really good minutes, I thought, against Scotland. They were one goal up in this game before things went poorly with an ill-timed red card in a friendly, and then it just kind of spiraled out of control. But what they showed in those 35 minutes gave me a bit of hope. Tahith Chong, who's obviously a name that's familiar to Premier League fans, is here. He's been brought in recently. He's a big kind of bet for Curaçao in the attacking play. Jurgen Locadia, who's in the U.S. second division, was the player who was sent off. He's the number 9 option. Look, this is a Dutch team that will play that kind of Dutch style. You've got the Bakuna brothers in midfield, Leandro Bakuna, Juninho Bakuna, players who bought into this project a long time. And that, I think, is what is so cool here is, yes, there are some of these bigger names who have come in later on in the qualifying process, later on in the process building towards the World Cup. Sondre Hansen, who's at Middlesbrough in the UK, is another kind of one of those names. But there are also guys like the Bakunas, like Eloy Room, like Jurgen Locadia, who have been with this project for a long time, who took this team from, hey, maybe we can make a Gold Cup, to literally making the World Cup. It's such a great story. And it's very reductive to say it that regardless of what happens at the World Cup, this is still a great story. But Curaçao aren't coming here to make up the numbers. They're going to try to play a little bit. I think this is a group that is probably not great for them in that aspect, but they're not a team that can kind of shut things down and defend, particularly against the physicality that they're going to face here. So their best option is to try and play their way through it and see what happens, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, what a story. The smallest ever nation to make a World Cup, and deservedly so.
Yeah, 100%. The qualification was incredible. I think this probably is a bridge too far. I think this group does look like a three-horse race. And actually, I think, as you say there, it's a bit of a shame for Curaçao, because if you look at the other teams in this, if you look at Uzbekistan, who are there for the first time, or Jordan, who are there for the first time, or even Cap Verde, who I'm starting to look at and be like, you know what? Maybe. Like, I do think you're kind of looking at it and thinking, this is not an ideal group. And I think that they might end up on that kind of big old zero. But you know what? They're going to have a load of fun when they do it.
Yeah. And also what hurts Curaçao is, you mentioned this might be a three-horse race. What's going to be huge for third place teams is goal differential, right? And so all three of these teams are looking at that Curaçao game and are saying, six goals would really help us, right? And so that's just going to be relentless. The physicality here is a big step up for these guys compared to what they're seeing, you know, kind of in and out of CONCACAF. Look, they've had good CONCACAF Gold Cup runs and they were great in qualifying, but the level here is just going to be completely different. But hey, they step on the pitch for the first time in Houston against Germany, and they last for 20 minutes, they last for 30 minutes, and you will just kind of feel that build. And look, that's what makes the World Cup great. And Curaçao don't have to win a game for this to be a success. Like, maybe they go toe-to-toe with Cote d'Ivoire for 40 minutes. Like, that's success for this Curaçao side. So they're a fun team to watch. I think people will really enjoy them. Their stories are just great. Like, there's no team bus on Curaçao. They just have an old school bus that they return to. And that was part of it. On our World Cup After Dark preview podcast, we brought in John Arnold, who's a great CONCACAF voice. Mm. And one of the points that he made that really stuck with me is this worked for Curaçao because they made it fun for these guys, because they're asking guys to fly from their clubs, who generally don't want guys to go on international break, right? Like, clubs prefer players to stay, to fly across the ocean, to land on a tiny Caribbean island and play two games. Look, if it's not fun, guys are not going to do that. And so Curaçao deserve a lot of credit for making it fun for those guys. And now they're being rewarded for it. And it's just cool to see.
Yeah, it is great to see them at this World Cup indeed. Right, that'll do us for Group E. When we come back on the other side, we've got Group F, which is going to be a lot of fun, I think. Netherlands, Japan, Sweden and Tunisia. We'll be stuck into that on the other side. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to the final part of Ranks FC. We're heading into Group F. It's Jack Collins and Austin Miller alongside you. The Netherlands, Japan, Sweden and Tunisia in Group F. And I don't think this one is necessarily as clear cut as some people might be making out. Austin, we'll start with the Dutch. I mean, look, the quality at the back end in midfield, absolutely unquestionable. There is perhaps a little bit of a question over a lack of goals. Maybe Daniel Marlen and that form we've seen at Roma could be the answer, but I don't necessarily trust Koeman to give him the nod through the middle. They lost 1-0 to Algeria in their first warm-up game, and they looked really, really, really blunt, albeit against a very good Algeria team, I think. Koeman's a question mark. Is he going to stick rigidly to that Cruyff 4-3-3 that he loves so much when it doesn't necessarily suit this group of players as much as it might have suited others? I mean, look, in fairness, if he does play Mickey van der Ven at left back and Dumfries on the right, it will naturally effectively become a 3-4-3 anyway. But I do look at this team and think all the pieces kind of should be in place, and I'm not getting any of the positive vibes that I really should be with a team of this much quality.
This feels like it should be a great opportunity for the Netherlands, right? Always the World Cup bridesmaid. They are maybe the best national team to have never won the World Cup. This might be a really good chance for them to win the World Cup. But yeah, something kind of feels off. And I think the biggest part of it is, what are they doing at the nine position? And that is a question that can haunt high-level teams. And when your answer to that question might be, it's fine, Memphis Depay lives at a five-star hotel in Sao Paulo and plays for Corinthians, I don't know that I'm feeling super great about that going into the World Cup. And then you've got the Daniel Malin question, or maybe they're just spamming Wout Weghorst and they're just running that bit back from the 2022 World Cup. that feels like that the type of question that may not cost them in this group, may not cost them as they go forward in the round of 16. But when they come up against a fellow European elite or against an Argentina or a Brazil, a South American side, when they play the best sides at this World Cup, that feels like a position of question for them in a way that it maybe isn't for other teams here.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is it. When you walk through this midfield, it's a joke on paper, right? You're talking about Gravenberch and Reinders and Cope Miners, De Jong, Quinton Timber, who I just think is an absolutely glorious player. And I'm surprised there wasn't more eyes on him when he made that move to Marseille. The back line has quality and stardust sprinkled all over it. And look, their goalkeeping core is the envy, I think, of many teams that are not called Spain. Verbruggen and Roofs, who have both had absolutely outrageous seasons. And Mark Flecken is your third choice. He is a more than capable goalkeeper. I don't think they're going to concede loads, but I'm completely with you in that it feels like Koeman has his favourites, is going to stick to this system. And I'm thinking Brian Brobbey's been a good option for Sunderland, hasn't he? He's run around and he's held the ball up and he's brought other players into play. And you're saying, okay, behind that, you've got a Memphis or you've got a Donyell Marlon or a Crescencio Somerville or a Noah Lang, people who can get the ball, take on players in the final third and make things happen. Maybe you do just want a number nine who's going to make it stick. But I think that Koeman's going to be too wedded to his ideals to actually let this team flourish in the way that they perhaps could.
Yeah, and that kind of feels like the big question here. And it's a question that I think is worth hammering again, because if the Netherlands want to win the World Cup, they're going to have to probably beat an elite team at some point. They're probably gonna have to beat multiple elite teams, right? And so what is the approach to that match? And can Koeman be flexible enough to find the right pieces at the right spots in that moment? Because look, you said it, the midfield here is on par with just about every other midfield you'll see at this tournament. And the defense is solid. The goalkeeping situation is good. But look, at the end of the day, this all boils down to it. And this is, I think, a point that is always worth hammering about international football. We're not playing a 38-game season here, right? We're not giving a chance for general quality to just consistently rise to the top because it's a big enough sample size. This is small sample size where stupid stuff matters all the time, right? One bounce, one flick, and boom, your World Cup is completely changed. And can Netherlands get that bounce to maybe finally go their way? What are they doing to determine that? Can they be that much better than the team that they're playing? That kind of feels like those are the questions we're asking about the ceiling. And I think this group is particularly interesting in that they're going to be asked a lot of different questions by the other three teams in this group in the group stage. I think we're going to learn a lot about them. And I think that Algeria friendly was also a pretty good data point of, kind of makes you think.
Yeah, I mean, look, of all the kind of major nations, those kind of maybe tier one and tier two nations that you're talking about, all the way from, you know, the very top of that pile in Spain and France, etc., all the way down to maybe like a Belgium, the Netherlands are the side that I look at with the groups that they have and think, you'll probably make it through because, like, the chances are you're going to be, at the very, very least, a best place, third place finisher. But I think they might be the one that disappoints perhaps the most in the group stage. And I just can't shake that feeling. And I don't know what it is about this group. I don't know if it's that I've just never hugely loved Koeman as a manager, but there's something about them that just isn't making me feel like this is going to be their time. And, you know, beautiful bridesmaids dressed in orange and all of those elements of it. I would like that to change. I like the Dutch and I like this Dutch team, but I just don't know if I feel that this is their time. And there's a lot of people, I think, feeling very similarly. And look, part of that is the quality of the rest of this group. So let's come on to some of them. Let's start with Japan, because this is a very, very good team. They're settled. They're well-drilled. They're very comfortable in their own skin. Moriyasu has built something over a very long period of time. It's not taken loads and loads of revolutions. It's been a constant and slow evolution. And it feels like they're reaping the rewards of that. It's almost certainly going to be a 3-4-2-1, although they have experimented at times with two up top. The press is well-coordinated and incredibly aggressive in that final third in terms of trying to win the ball back. And yes, they've had a couple of major injuries. Mitoma and Minamino being out is a blow for this Japanese side. But there's still a lot of quality here. And I think that looking at this group, when I kind of glance at it all on paper, I kind of have them as the favorites.
I love Japan. I love their commitment to the style that they play. I love the way that they play. I love the forwardness that they bring. I love that it doesn't kind of look like anything else you see international football in this day and age. Like, it's very unique. It's very Japanese. I am very concerned about the loss of Mitola and Minamino because I think those are two of their elite players who can fit in the style that they're playing and also rise above that style and be a difference maker. But I think Miriasu has been very clear about that. One of the things that he said was, look, we're bummed for those guys. It's bad for those guys, but we know what we're doing when we have players that we can call in to be successful. I firmly believe that. Japan have a plug-and-play style that is very deep within what Japan is trying to do, right? There's some very good Bundesliga influences here. There's a reason I think that you see so many Japanese players go to the Bundesliga and have success. And I think it's all well and good for them to say that, but the loss of that level of quality is what kind of gives me pause here. I would love to be proven wrong. I love this Japan team. Them blowing through the group stage with 9 points and bagging the goals in, like I've seen them do in Asian qualifying, would just make me so happy and warm inside. But I'm just that bit worried about that those two losses in particular.
Yeah, I mean, look, anyone would struggle with losing a player, I think in particular of Mitoma's quality, right? Like the individual brilliance that he has at his disposal is something that I don't think should be understated. But you're kind of just looking at it, be like, well, who jumps into that spot? And Takefusa Kubo, the pressure on his shoulders now, yeah, I think is absolutely massive in terms of kind of stepping up here and thinking, okay, how is this all going to shake out? There feels more kind of on him. And Daichi Kamada's had a very good season with Crystal Palace, but in a deeper role, are they going to ask him to maybe do a little bit more from a forward-thinking perspective? They have players up top, though, who are just incredibly good at what they do. I think Ueda will lead the line, has had another good season for Feyenoord. In Dyson Maeder, and he's a player, obviously, I watch quite a lot with Celtic, arguably the best pressing forward on the planet, is ridiculous what he gets through in terms of a game. And if you're, you know, tired after 70 minutes in the heat and suddenly they chuck Dyson Maeder at you, you're going to be like, are you joking? Like, are you actually joking me? I have to deal with this lunatic running around after me and trying to steal the ball every given opportunity. I just think they have slightly different... It's not going to be, I don't think, as majestic as it might have been with Mitoma and Minamino in there. But I think that they have just kind of a scary element of, we are so well disciplined and we know exactly how we want to go at you in minute one, in minute 40, in minute 60, in minute 80, that I think they're going to be a weirdly difficult proposition for quite a lot of teams.
Absolutely. And that, I think, speaks to the consistency they have with Moriyasu, right? He's been in charge of Japan for a very long time. This isn't the first rodeo. It's the third World Cup that he's been in charge of this Japan side. And they got so close at those other two World Cups. I think they won a lot of hearts in 2018 and in 2022. And yet, the questions that those attacking players ask of your backline are really different than a lot of other questions that they're going to get. And I think that is the relentlessness and the consistency with which they press just makes it so difficult. And you're right, you can't switch off for a single second. And in this group in particular, I think they can find a lot of success because, all right, we talked about the Netherlands backline. Yeah, that's a really strong backline, but I think they can challenge that. But I look at Sweden, I look at Tunisia, and those are two teams that I look and I say, this Japan frontline can have a lot of joy against those types of teams because those are backlines that I don't think can consistently play around or play through or even play over that amount of pressure for that amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's come on to them and let's start with Sweden because I have some serious questions about this Swedish team. They did enough to get out of the playoffs and
Two World Cup qualifying wins wasn't enough for you, Jack? You wanted more than two games won in the entire World Cup qualifying process? What are you talking about?
I will say this. It does feel to me that Graham Potter has come in and actually kind of calmed everything down after the JDT experiment, which, I mean, look, was probably never going to work. If you're going to put a Dane in charge of the Swedes, there is probably going to be fireworks. But it feels like Potter, at the very least, kind of reunited the fan base with the squad and at least gave them something to hang on to. Now, those two wins in qualification in terms of the playoffs, I was not particularly impressed with the way that they went about either. They were lovely moments and, you know, the Jokeres goal and all of the celebrations at the beautifully named Strawberry Arena were very, very nice to see. But, you know, watching them in that game against Norway, they lost 3-1. And I think that probably does them a massive favour. That was a Norway side missing Erling Haaland and Martin Ødegaard. And it should have been 5-0. Brilliant goal from Alexander Isak, but completely and utterly against the run of play. And they've done better in today's game. I watched them just before we recorded this, draw 2-2 with Greece. And I think this Greek side are better than people necessarily give them credit for. And they did go 2-1 up and ended up kind of conceding a 96-minute equaliser. Obviously, there's firepower here, Austin. And a defensive set generally feels like a pretty smart way to try and get the best out of that front too. But I just don't know if there's enough elsewhere to justify the fact that they might be able to get through this group at this point.
Yeah, and so much of it is going to rely on those attacking players, because I think the most likely path out of this group for Sweden is a first match day game against Tunisia, where Tunisia are going to try and muck everything up and make life difficult, and Sweden have to find a way to score, and they probably have to find a way to score multiple goals in that game. So I don't know that I'm backing them much against the Netherlands and Japan in those other two games. Look, the attacking talent is intriguing. It's been intriguing on paper through the entirety of World Cup qualifying. Isak, Jakres, Alanga's another interesting player here, right? You've got Benjamin Nygren kind of behind those guys, and you've got four, I think, attacking players that you can convince me of. I'm really concerned about what they're trying to do defensively, in that I don't know what they're trying to do defensively. And look, how'd they beat Poland to get here? They beat them 3-2, right? This is not a Sweden side that can consistently, I think, defend. You mentioned they gave up 3 to Norway in a friendly. They're conceding 2 to Greece in friendlies. Like, this is a team that is going to have to score goals to win games. And that's just going to get progressively harder as this World Cup goes on. That's going to be hard to do against Tunisia, who we'll get onto in a second, right? Like, that's going to be the level that they have to hit right off the top. I personally am not a fan of this Sweden team. I didn't like the whole qualification thing. Like, look, the fact that they topped a UEFA Nations League group 4 years ago or whatever it was, that also had Azerbaijan and Slovenia. Like, look, that's just Slovakia, I should say. That's not how you should make the World Cup, but that's how they're here. They're going to be interesting because, like, they have to play interesting games, so I think they're fun from a neutral perspective, but this feels like it might be a lot of 4-2 losses here.
Yeah, I mean, look, the lack of full assists from the fullbacks is potentially an issue. Like, Gabriel Gudmundsson's had a brilliant season for Leeds. I think he's a wonderful footballer. 0 goals, 0 assists, 1 own goal, which I was lucky enough to witness in the flesh. Couldn't do that if you gave him 100 tries, if he tried to do that, right? But it is what it is. And I'm concerned about the kind of ammunition for the firepower, if you will. And I think that's going to be the strange thing. They're going to have to take things out of nothing. And look, Jokeres and Isak can both do that. Whether they can do it enough, I think that they could be in trouble here. And look, let's come on to Tunisia, because they are the final team we're going to cover today. Like Cote d'Ivoire, qualified without conceding a goal in CAF, but on a slightly different level in terms of the quality they came up against. Three different managers in charge during that qualification process doesn't scream stability. Sabali Lamouchi came in after the disappointment of AFCON. Slightly younger focus in terms of the players. It's going to be a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1. They have scored 1 goal since Lamouchi took over, which was against Haiti in March. They did put up a decent fight against Austria in the game they played last week. They are 100%, Austin, not going to be a neutral's favorite, Tunisia.
No, they are not. They have a 10 p.m. Eastern kickoff against Sweden, where you're just really counting on Sweden to bring the excitement in that game, because if not, you might be dozing off on the couch during that one. Look, all African qualifying campaigns are not created equal. Tunisia, as you said, they didn't concede a goal. They played 10, won 9, scored 28. Their best challenge in World Cup qualifying came from Equatorial Guinea, and Equatorial Guinea were docked 9 points in qualifying, right? They had 6 that they were docked for Emilio Nsue, who was not eligible, but then somehow became eligible. And then they got docked another 3 because they just didn't show up to play Malawi. Look, that was the type of competition that Tunisia were dealing with here. The 0 goals conceded is the number to count on. They think that there's a chance to get through at the World Cup by playing 3-0-0 draws. And until they are proven that they can't play 3-0-0 draws, that's what they're going to look to do. I thought they were decent against Austria in that friendly. I thought they had some moments going forward. They hit the post a couple of times. They hit the crossbar. I was intrigued by that. I think the younger focus here is interesting, right? Yassine Maria, Ali Maloul, Osawa Haladi, Ferjan Sassi, Naim Sliti. Those are players who were big in their AFCON campaign, big for them in qualifying, that aren't here. They were kind of ushered out. Dylan Braun is a player who wasn't here in March and has come back in. I think there is kind of some hope that maybe after this World Cup, Tunisia look to be a bit more progressive in what they're trying to do football-wise. I think maybe you'll see them lean more towards the Morocco-Algeria side of North African international teams and less towards the Egypt side of approaches. But look, the recipe at this World Cup is pretty simple. They are going to look to be collectively strong at the back. I think Ali Abdi, who's at Nice, is going to be big there. He's a left back. He can give them something going forward in those moments that they need to. They have a lot of different midfield players trying to grind things up. Arani Kadira is interesting, right? That's Sami Kadira's younger brother. He just switched to this Tunisia team in March. There's a couple of interesting players. I like Khalil Ayari. He's at PSG. Ismail Garbi, who's at Augsburg, who's a former French and Spanish youth international. The dream scenario here is that they can make a back seven or eight that is collectively strong enough to allow them to play some flair players and attack. But I just don't think there's going to be enough of a commitment to attack to really make things matter in this. And look, they're going to look to defend, set pieces, counterattack. It's the recipe for this Tunisia side. It's a group that maybe doesn't scream that that's going to be successful. But look, Tunisia could maybe find some joy against Sweden in that first game, right? That's a defense in midfield that I'm not super convinced by. Japan and Netherlands are probably going to be tougher asks, but until they're scored on, they're just going to muck things up.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you can sum up this entire Tunisia squad with one fact, which is Ali Abdi, who I think is a really, really good player, right? Is a 32-year-old left back. He's the top scoring player of this squad that's traveling. That is, I think, it in a nutshell, if you want to see it. And ultimately, as you say, it's going to be, if they can take a lead, Christ, we could be 11 men around the box for the entire game. And look, if it works, it works. But I don't think that anyone's going to particularly enjoy watching them all that much, if I'm honest.
No, and one final shout for Hannibal Mesbury, who's at Burnley. I thought he was really good against Austria. He's going to stand out. He's got the hair. He's got the curls. Like, you're going to notice him immediately on the pitch, and then you'll notice that he's actually playing some good stuff. He's another kind of flary-like guy that they're looking at. There's some young attacking players here that I like. I just don't think this is maybe the tournament where those are going to be the type of players who have success. But maybe going forward, we'll see a little bit more out of Tunisia.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the experience here sets them up a little bit nicely for the future, but this might not be their tournament. Austin, it's been such a pleasure working through all these teams with you. Can you please tell the Ranks FC listeners, the Rank Squad themselves, where they can find you through this entire tournament?
Yeah, so if you liked a five-minute breakdown of Tunisia doing terrible things playing football, what if I could offer you a 15-minute breakdown of that? That's what you can get on the World Cup After Dark podcast. We have group-by-group previews for all 12 of the groups. We're digging in on all the teams from 1 to 48, giving everybody their due. You can find World Cup After Dark wherever you find your podcast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you want us to be, we're there. If you're looking for a one-stop shop, patreon.com/WCAD, our preview hub right there. First thing you'll see on the page, you've got links to all of our previews. As we record this, 10 of our 12 previews are out. By Monday, all 12 of them will be out. So if you start Monday, you probably have a good chance to be able to finish to Friday if you commit some time to it. So I would highly encourage that. And then look, during the World Cup, we'll be World Cup After Darking hopefully just about every single day. Our approach to football is to try and find the joy out of it, to make it fun. We are big on the tactics without hopefully getting too deep into the tactics. So if you enjoyed what you heard from me here today, there's a pretty good chance you're going to like what you hear on the World Cup After Dark podcast. I'd highly encourage you to check it out. And yeah, there's some really good stuff on the group previews. Jack, I think the Group K preview in particular was pretty darn good.
Yeah, I heard that there was a very special guest on that. You know, Austin and Amit have got these brilliant journalists in. You know, they've got John Arnold, as you mentioned earlier, Henry Bushnell, and then like a polar bear in Arlington, Texas, there's me popping up on the Group K preview. So I'm in that as well, if you fancy it. And I couldn't recommend it enough. World Cup After Dark, it really is the one-stop shop for international football and one of my favorite podcasts out there. Austin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Cheers, Jack. Thanks for having me on.
and the brilliant Austin Miller. I've been Jack Collins. This has been the World Cup preview for Groups D to F, the second of our four going out here on Ranks FC. The next two will be out, I think, on Monday and Wednesday, getting you all set up for the World Cup. So we'll be all ready to go when things kick off on Thursday, the 11th of June. Thank you so much for listening as ever, Rank Squad. And we'll see you all very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.